session number 17679, Reel 1.
Here we
go. Russell, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
I was born in Kingston, Surrey on the 18th of March, 1933.
Can you tell me how and when you came to be in the army, please?
How I came into being? Well, the government sort of volunteered me in 1951. I was National Service, and I think it was something like the 7th or 8th of May 1951. I went to Stoughton Barracks in Guildford, the Queen's Royal Regiment.
How did you feel about being called up?
Actually, I suppose I quite looked forward to it, really, because all my friends had been called up, and my brother and his family and my uncle, everyone had been served in some way or other. Yeah, I didn't bother me,
And did you do your basic training in Guildford?
Guildford, yeah. 6 weeks basic training. Never come outside the barracks. It's funny because I only live a few miles from Guildford, and my mother said, I always remember I went in on a Thursday, and with two other guys I went to school with, and they said, oh, we'd probably be home the weekend, on a Saturday. Silly fool. So 6 weeks, we got out after 6 weeks. They said, well, okay, lads, you've got 2 weeks embarkation, you're going to Germany, and that was it.
How did they treat you in the basic training?
I suppose it was pretty tough, really. It was tough, actually, but I did an inkling what it was going to be like, because when I was about 11 or 12, I was in the Sea Cadets, which is obviously not the same as the regular army, but I had an idea what military discipline was going to be like, And they chased us, ran us ragged, really, and which is, the way the army run things.
But we sometimes hear nowadays about bullying of new recruits. Was there anything of that kind?
No. Funny enough, one of the guys I went over, a guy called Freddie Beadle, he cracked. He got a medical discharge after about 4 weeks. He couldn't handle the it's bullshit, really, I suppose, making up your bed and doing your brass. He couldn't hack it, and poor Freddie, he's not wrong with him, really. He just couldn't handle it. So they gave him the old discharge. It wasn't suitable.
Was it because he was unable to do what they were telling him to?
That's right, yeah. Because everyone's going, go here, go there, run this, stop that, just keep you on your move all the time, but that's the army. That's the way the army used to work. I don't know now. They're probably full of counsellors now, I suppose,
Can you tell me how you got your posting to Korea?
They just said, okay, lads, we need two companies for the Royal Fusiliers, which were in the same. In the same town, a place called Iselohn, just outside Dortmund in Germany. We were in the same brigade, actually. And they said, okay, lads, C Company of the Queens will now be C Company of the Fusiliers. So they transferred us en masse, like that. Although, to be fair, myself and a guy called City Church, we actually volunteered because I think they wanted to keep us behind, or didn't want us anyway. But I did want a soldier in Germany, because that's a hell of a posting, Nothing at all, Germany.
What was your objection to Germany?
Well, the thing, it was what we call sort of bullshit. You had parades and more parades. You had to impress the Germans, because Rommel was buried just down the road, and it was pretty anti-British there, actually. And we used to get these little kids in the wintertime, about 7 or 8, you'd be on guard duty with your best boots and stuff, and the kids would be throwing snowballs at, and because you couldn't do much about it, really. If they were a bit bigger, you could have done, but, So when the opportunity arrived, and all the guys I'd done with basic training with, 120 of us, I thought, well, I'm not getting left out, So I figured, well, get away from Germany and volunteer for a career,
Which place in Germany was this?
A place called Iselohn. There's a big military hospital there, and there was two battalions, the Fusiliers and the Queens, and there was an armoured regiment there too, I think 8th Hussars, from memory.
What date approximately was the posting to Korea?
Let's see now. I have to backtrack it now. We were there about just 100 years, so I suppose that would be the king when the king died in November. I suppose it'd be sometime in June or July, I suppose, something like that. Because we backtrack, well, going forward a bit, we arrived in Korea, I remember this, on the 4th of August 1952. So we, it was a 5 or 6 week journey, so we left in, you know,
end of June,
yeah. So we must have, yeah, come home that, you know, early part of 52, because we did, we went to Norfolk for some training, innit, for about 6 weeks anyway.
How did you feel about the Korean War? Where had you been following it?
Korea? Where was Korea? You know, that was most of the guys, think about, you know, their attitude, they didn't know where it was. We had to look on the map, find where it was, you know. We all know where Hong Kong and Singapore was, but I mean, Korea was just another place, you know.
And the transfer from the Queen's to the Royal Fusiliers, did that make much difference to you?
Well, no, it was still the same army. No. So, lucky enough, they were most of the guys. The Queens were basically from Bermondsey, which is South London, and the Fusiliers are City London Regiment. So they're all the same. They all virtually knew each other anyway. You know, I mean, I was what they call a Swede anyway, because I lived in Surrey, which was about 7 or 8 miles out of London. You know, a carrot. You know.
What was the journey like out to Korea?
It took us about nearly 6 weeks on an old German boat. It was the old Empire Hallidale, and it was so hot we used to sleep on deck. Well, everyone used to sleep on deck anyway, you know. And we used to have these sort of mess tables where you know, and wooden tables where you had to scrub down every day and get your own food, you know. When we did go ashore, we went ashore places like Aden, Colombo, went to Hong Kong, and all they did, we used to get all our best gear on and march around the town, you know. And they used to let us stay ashore for a couple of hours and bring us back again, like, you know, just to show the locals we were there, you know. No, it was no cruise anyway, that's for sure. Different coming back, it's better coming back.
Did you get any kind of briefing about what to expect and how to go on once you got there?
No. Well, yeah, we had lectures what to expect, because we'd had guys who'd been there before. Actually, some guys from Middlesex. We had a guy with us called Titch Sellings who was with Middlesex, but he got wounded and silly, so he came back with us and got killed. But they, you know, we were briefed what to expect. It was going to be trench warfare. Like fighting patrol, stuff like that, you know, barbed wire and was the usual rubbish.
And what did you find once you disembarked? Did you disembark in Korea or Japan?
No, Busan. We got there on the 4th of August and we disembarked on the 5th of August. Actually, it's on film, actually, on the 5th of August. And we got on this train and we were over, I think it must have been at least 24 hours on these wooden slats, you know. Seats, because we had all full gear with us, you know, and we had to put guards on the train because the usual old rubbish, or you could be guerrillas, which is probably so. There probably were guerrillas around, but we didn't see any anyway. All we see was a lot of burnt out Russian tanks as we went up the line, you know. Went to a place called Tok Chon was the railhead, and then we sort of went in from there, you know, went in the reserve position.
But what impression had Korea made on you at first when you got there?
In mystery, like, I thought, where's this smell coming from? It really, really ponged, you know. But we always saw basically was the military. Where we landed, well, obviously was the military docks, and it was obviously a military base. We didn't see too many civilians at all, you know. Even going up country, it was flattened by then. I mean, I'd been up through Seoul a couple of three times, you know, so it was flat as a pancake.
What did you find at Tok Chon?
Tok Chon was the end of the railhead, that was the railhead, that's where the railway finished. And we got off there, and then we went into a reserve position, actually. I think it was near Gloucester Valley, actually, you know, where the Gloucesters got done. Yeah, we were there for a while until we got ourselves organised, you know.
What did getting organised involve?
or getting acclimatized, charged, getting your gear sorted out, you know, sort of getting fit, really, you know. In the first thing they did, I was a machine gunner actually, and they said, okay lads, it was August and it's really hot, and some lieutenant said, okay, so we'll go for a walk, you know, or a hike. And of course you're carrying all your gear, from memory, I might be wrong here, but the gun was either £40 and a tripod £50, or vice versa, but I was carrying the gun. It was bloody heavy, you know, and after about 9 miles I think we'd had enough, you know. Some were just trying to get us fit, but I think they went the wrong way about it. They should have worked us in nice and easy, you know, but we got fit anyway.
What kind of weaponry were you to take into the front line?
Well, obviously it was an infantry battalion, and I was a machine gunner. My gun, you won't believe this, it was a Vickers medium machine gun, was made in 1915, the old Vickers. And I first went into the line as a guide, actually. They always sent so many of the guys in to lead the rest of the guys in, because you're going into a position you don't know. Obviously, you're going in the night time, and I went in. I think you must have about 36 hours before to get the lie of the land, and when our guys come in, I just sort of led them to the positions where they could take the guns out there, take the other guns out and put our guns in straight away, so you know if anything happened we could, you know, give cover in fire, as it were, you know.
Which unit did you replace on the front line?
Welsh Regiment. It was called, I think it's the Royal Welsh actually.
And
go on, carry on. Yeah, no, it's all right. Yeah. It was a pretty soft position, actually. On reflection, I mean, when we first went there, of course, you think, Jesus, is this, you know, this, where are they, sort of thing. But I was talking to a machine gun sergeant, and he said, well, you know, with a machine gun, I don't suppose you know this, but you have set positions and sort of angles and spots where they come, and the ranges and stuff, mainly ranges. Well, our nearest range really was about 2,800 yards. It was a big plain, actually, a place called the Samachon Valley, because it was a soft position, really. I think that's put most of the new troops in there, you know, so, because, I mean, the Chinese wouldn't dare come across there. I mean, they'd got flattened, you know, but we didn't know that at the time, you know.
What did you think to this ancient Vickers machine gun that you had to use?
Well, he wasn't ancient to us. I mean, he'd been well used in World War One, World War Two, and it was still a very effective weapon. You know, if it hit you, I mean, you stay dead, like, you know. I mean, fire from memory about 600 rounds a minute, and you could fire a maximum range, I think it was about 4,000. It's all coming back now. About 4,500 yards. That's killing range. Because the arc, when the bullets fell, they was like, you know, about 150 yards. But anything in there would know it, sort of.
Were there any problems with using it?
Yeah. It was okay in the summertime, no problem at all, because it was a water cooled gun, actually. It wasn't air cooled, water cooled. Because when you get your first frost, it freezes up if you don't watch out. But we were talking to the guys, you know, who we relieved, and they said, well, what they used to do, they used to just cock it and fire it every 10 or 15 minutes just to keep it from seizing up, you know. Going back on freezing up, I say I was in a machine gun platoon, we had 10 Jeeps, 10 brand new American Jeeps, and someone hadn't put enough antifreeze in, and I think the first big frost, I think we lost 8 of them, and all the engines had to go back to Japan to be repaired, you know. But because, I mean, you're talking about 40 below, which was cold, very cold actually.
But starting off, you were in the summer.
Yeah, well, yeah.
What were the positions like that you occupied in what you describe as a soft position?
Yeah, well, they'd been established for a while. It wasn't that far from Panmunjom, actually. You could see the balloons and the searchlights. You know, I suppose I can't remember offhand how far it was, but it couldn't have been too far away. And they'd been well established. The Canadians had been there before us, before the Welsh, and they were really deep and they was really solid, you know. So we didn't have to dig in at all, really, you know. So I think it was there, and that was it, really. It was a good steady position. Like we had a platoon in front of us. Actually, all my mates, actually, 9 platoons, see coming. They were all in front of us on a spur. They could have been a bit in trouble if they had got done, you know. But we had them well covered anyway, you know. They had two guns, a pair of guns. Because in the battalion, you'd have 6 guns, like 3 pair of guns, machine guns, I'm talking about. It was a pretty safe position, actually.
So which platoon were you in?
Medium machine gun platoon. That was a support company. We used to go, well, as the name implies, we used to support all the other companies, rifle companies, you know. Which there'd be 4.
And how comfortable or uncomfortable could you be in these trenches?
Well, we weren't too bad. I mean, once you got used to the rats, I mean, we used to get friendly with the old rats, you know. Because we all had the old jabs with the plague and stuff like that, you know. But that was pretty comfortable. And of course, the guys who've been, you know, been there before, we had the tricks of the trade. As when the winter came, we could make the fires, you know, at the old shell case, and with a diesel drip, you have a shell case and an ammunition box, and you just let it drip, and it sort of heats up, you know. It's hard to explain, but once you see
what it, what is dripping?
Well, the diesel fuel is dripping, and that keeps you warm, like, you know. That's the heat. That's what you cook on as well.
Was it dangerous?
It could be, I think. Yeah, I think there must have been a few fires. We were pretty lucky because we used to keep our eye on it. I think they could be dangerous, I would have thought.
Did the rats interfere with you?
No, we left them alone and they left us alone, you know. They sort of scamped about, but after a while you get used to them, you know.
What were they living on then?
I suppose they must have been using, you know, the gear was leaving around, or food particles and what those are, you know. I don't think they was living on bodies, because I don't think there's any bodies there.
Was it, in this first position, was it quiet in the event, or did you see action in the first?
We saw a wee bit, it's funny, professional soldiers, especially officers, they always want to get medals. It's crazy. I don't know why they do, but they do. And they had a brilliant idea that if we take a gun, just one gun, into the paddy field, we could draw a bit of fire, probably, you know, maybe draw some of the Chinese out, and we could have a sort of capture few, which is impossible. I mean, you know, these guys have been around a long while, these Chinese. There was no idiots, you know. But we fired, but we never drew them out. I think they knew our little game anyway, you know. But we used to fire regularly every night. I always remember there was the Chinese were building a crawl trench, and I always remember it was like a 3 backwards, and we fired 15 minutes all through the night, and they still dug it, would you believe, you know. Every 15 minutes we give them a few bursts, and they still dug the bloody thing, you know. Though we did knock out one lot anyway. We got a bit of a citation for that, but it's amazing what they could do, you know.
How far away was this trench?
Say 2,000. I think from memory about 3,000 yards. But you can see it. You can see them, you know. You can see it being dug anyway, you know. You knew it was being dug anyway.
Was the ground soft or hard?
No, this was the summertime. This was the summertime. But the Chinese had a... They're very ingenious, the old gooks. We used to have an airstrike. We could always... Or you could put your clock by it. You used to have 2 airstrikes, one at midday. This is from carrier-borne planes, by the way. One at midday and one at 4 o'clock. And they used to drop this napalm on them. But what they did, they used to dig a little trench around their trench, so the napalm run down and used to run away, you know? It's pretty ingenious, the old Chinese.
So, were the... machine gun platoon expected also to go on patrol?
Not normally, no. You wouldn't normally take a gun out like that. I mean if what normally would happen, you would take something like you might take one of the old American sort of 30 caliber Browning, you know, the air cool jobs. But I think someone was just trying to draw a bit of fire, and they would draw fire, you know. If we started opening up, which we did do, they would want to come and see what's happening, like, you know. They would want to know, and they would send a patrol out. But for some reason, I think they must have guessed what we was up to, because they didn't come out. The only time they did come out was in November 52. It was tragic, really, because we sent out a company, dog company, D company, to do a patrol, and they ran into a battalion, a company ran into a battalion of Chinese, and they got well stuffed, you know. I think brought George, a bloke called George Hoskinson, won the DCM on it. And the thing about that was that everyone knew the patrol had been put back a couple of times, but bearing in mind all the porters were Korean, and you can bet your life they were getting information back to the Chinese, that's for certain, you know. And we figure, why did the hell this colonel, you know, why did they send this out? Why did they send D Company out, you know? But they did. They put it back from memory a couple of nights, actually. And then they did go out, and they bumped this big Chinese, you know, battalion strength. And that too, what they did, they had to go up this, I've forgot the number of the hill now, that our boys had to go up the hill to get away, you know, from the Chinese. And George was on it, had the 31 set, and was sort of George, because we could hear him on the 31 set, he was calling in fire to get our lads off, you know. And I think from memory, actually Dave was there, you know, little Dave, he was there, so he'd probably tell you what really happened, because I was only firing, you know. And I think we lost about, of the company, which would be about 110, I think we lost about 90 dead, wounded and missing, you know. And George lost an eye and got the DCM for it, you know, because he was calling the fire, sort of giving us where they were going, like, you know. And I think we got most of them anyway.
But you were on the machine gun supporting them.
Mm.
How much did you know of what was going on at the time when you were getting orders to support them?
Well, you could hear it going on, like, you know, you could hear them. Mm-hmm.
Were there any other actions you can recollect?
Well, no, that was the big one, actually. Most it was small stuff. I mean, we used to give covering fire mostly. Most of the rifle companies, like, used to send out the patrols, and if they got in any real trouble and we could help them out, obviously we did do, you know. But we was also next to the 1st American Marine Division, and we could hear the same with them as well on their sets. We had the same frequency, you know, and they used to get hammered. We used to in the San Michelin Valley, they used to send patrols across this stream. The Marines used to go across this stream, you know, obviously going out on some sort of recce patrols. And they used to get really hammered. I don't know why. I mean, you think they would have wised up after a while, because I mean that they were good troops, and you know the Marine Corps was. I mean the rest of them were okay, but the Marine Corps were pretty good. But we used to give them a bit of covering fire too, like, you know, probably unbeknown to them anyway.
Why are you so confident that the Korean porters were sending intelligence to the Chinese?
Well, if you work it out, I mean, they sort of I've got no way of knowing, obviously. I mean, I can't say put my finger, but anything went on, someone knew about it. I mean, how come we kept putting this patrol back, you know, because it wasn't right, or something was going on anyway. And everyone thought, well, this got bad vibes, you know. And they still went out. I mean, I'm not blaming anyone. I mean, you know, God is, you know.
How much incoming fire did you have from Chinese artillery or mortars?
Nothing. Mortars mainly, but artillery was non-existent as far as we're concerned. I mean, you know, if you were silly, I mean, if you started getting on the skyline or playing silly buggers, I mean, they'd throw a few over, actually. I mean, going back to 9 between, they were on the spur in front of us, and a very good friend of mine, you got a bloke called Jack Hawkins, actually. Jack was what we used to call a chow hound. He was always hungry, you know, and he used to have the rations come up, and Jack would be first in the queue. Well, one day Jack was a bit unlucky, because Jack Jack ran it, head of the queue, and they stuck a few mortars out, and Jack got 14 pieces of shrapnel on his head, so he wasn't lucky. But yeah, mostly mortars really, and that was most of the stuff, you know. But if you just kept your head down, we used to have just like World War One, you know, we used to have these little signs that say, you know, you can be seen from here, keep your head down and stuff like that, you know.
At one particular point, you mean?
Yeah, in different parts, because all the trenches were connected, you know, obviously, you know, apart from the one at the spur in front of us. I mean, you know, they were a bit isolated.
How accurate was the enemy mortaring?
It wasn't too bad. It was pretty good, pretty good, you know.
Did you ever see any Chinese prisoners?
No, never seen any prisoners. No, I don't think we caught any. I don't think, from memory, they're pretty slippery customers, these old Chinese, you know.
What did you think of the enemy as a soldier?
Good. Yeah, I just think, yeah. They treated us like we treated them. I mean, this is only hearsay, so you can't say it's gospel, but they obviously didn't like the Americans much, because I think the Americans used to ill-treat them. I mean, I'll tell you what I heard anyway, so I didn't actually see it. But, I mean, if we went out to pick up our dead or something like that, they wouldn't fire. And like Christmas, when we were in the line at Christmas in 52, and it was a sort of unwritten agreement. We never fired them, and they never fired us, you know. I mean, so we treated them with a bit of respect, and they did the same with us. If you wanted to go out and be aggressive, they say, well, fine, they'd be aggressive too. But if you wanted, you know, anyone in the right mind, I mean, the peace talks were going on anyway, you might as well just sit down and hold your line, and you just wait for politicians to get this sorted out, you know.
What did you think of the talks that were going on at Panmunjom?
Well, all we used to get of the talks really were from the American. We used to have a British paper, I can't remember the name of it, but we used to have American Stars and Stripes, because that was a bit obviously pro-American. Well, it was American newspaper anyway, American service paper, and we used to it was always a slanted our way, you know. It was always the Chinese weren't cooperating, the Chinese weren't doing this, and Chinese weren't doing that, you know. But they didn't mention about MacArthur wanting to go up there and A-bomb them, but I mean, that's a different story, you know.
Was there much propaganda from the Chinese side that you took?
We used to listen to music. They used to have some nice music. They used to send us, you know, used to have these speakers and whiff these records across the paddy, like, which, you know, was great, because, I mean, it was a bit of music for us, you know, we didn't care.
But was there any printed propaganda?
Only from our side, actually. We used to find loads of it, like telling the Chinese to surrender and they'd be treated well, and the Koreans, I suppose, too. They'll be. No, we didn't bother much about it.
But did the Chinese also use their loudspeakers to tell you to go home or something?
Oh yeah, well that used to go with the music, you know. I mean, why are you fighting for the old American, blah blah blah, and you know, it's cobblers, like, you know, the sort of thing.
But do you think the propaganda had any effect on anybody?
No, not at all. If it didn't show the air crowd anyway. I can't see it would anyway, really. I think most of it was sort of pretty naive, I think. Although I think the prisoners got a bit brainwashed, you know. Like, you know, got some of the guys up there got to put through it, as it were.
So what, in general, was morale like in your unit in the front line?
Great, no problem at all. Good as gold. We looked after each other, and that was, you know, that was it. It was all for one and one for all, so, you know, we was all in the same boat, or in our case, all in the same trench.